I really was serious this time. I knocked again and waited, thinking about the missing hard case. "Mr. Tuyen, this is Sheriff Longmire. I got the key from the front desk, and I'm unlocking this door." I turned the key and swung the door open. There was an entryway to the bathroom on the left, and I could see an open closet where a number of expensive suits hung along with plaster-covered and freshly laundered shirts. I took a step inside and allowed my eyes to adjust. Tuyen's toiletry and personal items were on the bathroom counter, along with a hand towel, which was saturated with blood that hung from the lip of the sink, the excess dripping to the tile floor. I unsnapped the strap from my Colt and pulled it from my holster. I clicked off the safety, looked at the dark spots on the carpeting, and took another step inside. I raised my sidearm and heard a noise to my left. There were two double beds, with a kidney-shaped pool of blood at the foot of one, and there was more on the far side of the room. Even with the clattering of the aged air conditioner, I could tell the noise was coming from another room on the far side. It sounded like someone walking and possibly dragging something. I extended the large frame semi-automatic. There were some clothes lying on the unslept-in bed, and another pair of shoes, but what caught my attention was the phone cord that was stretched taut and led from the nightstand across the wall and out the adjoining doorway. I took another step and silently cursed the creaking floorboards under my boots. The noise from the other room stopped, and the phone cord grew slack and drooped to the carpet. I held the .45 toward the open doorway and took a deep, silent breath before taking another step. I took another and could hear a slight creak and saw a flicker of movement. I swung the Colt around, pointing it at whatever had made the noise. Tran Van Tuyen was holding a tan push-button phone in one hand and a blood-soaked towel to his head in the other. Even from this distance, I could hear Ruby's voice coming from the receiver of the telephone. "Mr. Tuyen, Mr. Tuyen, are you still there?" The blood from the wound at the side of his head had drained down to his face and stained his smile that half-beamed from across the room.
"Sheriff?"
The smile remained as his eyes rolled back in his head, and he slumped against the jamb, streaking a hand-wide smear of blood down the door and collapsing unconscious onto the carpet. Chapter 13. Cesar Vittoria thinks you did it. I listened to the squeal from under the hood as we turned the corner and figured the staff vehicle from the Powder Junction detachment of the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department was going to need a power steering unit and soon. Really? No. But we had a long talk about race relations. I drove the faded red Suburban to the address Philip Maynard had given us, as the bear fiddled with the non-functioning vents, finally settling on rolling down his window, which stuck about halfway. Santiago is a very intelligent young man. I'd given Sancho my truck after we'd gotten Tuyen stabilized and sent them rocketing off to the hospital back in Durant. I figured a one-way trip in the bullet was faster than a two-way trip with the EMTs. Even with the vast loss of blood, Tuyen had come to and said that he had no idea what had happened other than that he had entered the motel room and someone had struck him from behind. So we are basing our suspicions on a single set of motorcycle tracks outside the motel? Sort of. How sort of? I shrugged. Exclusively. He sighed. Why would Philip Maynard kill Hoti Paquette and then try to kill Tuyen? I don't know, but he seems our most likely suspect. Henry pulled his shoulder belt out where it hung loose across his chest. Drive carefully. I questioned the ability of this belt to keep me from slamming face first into the dash should we find ourselves in a crash. We were headed for the south side of town, near the rodeo grounds. He is our only suspect. He thought about it some more. Sometimes living in Wyoming has unexpected benefits. Vic says that most of the benefits of living in Wyoming are unexpected. She is a modern woman, and expects a great deal. I could feel him watching me before he turned back to the road and smiled. Philip Maynard's house wasn't really a house. It was more like an upscale chicken shack, which meant that in comparison to the other shacks that sat a little farther toward the banks of the middle fork of the Powder River, it seemed even more uninhabitable. Henry placed his hands on his hips and stood at the gate.
Where do you suppose the door is?
Drawing from my ranch upbringing, I'd say it's on the side. I followed him as he walked around the end of the ramshackle building, where we found a hollow cord door that had a tin sign tacked to the surface that read, "Keep Out." We could hear commercials squawking from the television inside, and I knocked on the door. We waited and listened, but heard nothing but the TV. This was getting reminiscent of Tran Van Tuyen's motel room. "Philip Maynard, this is Sheriff Longmire. Would you mind opening the door?" Nothing. We listened and learned how white our teeth and how fresh our breath could be if we would only use Brand X toothpaste, but nothing from Philip Maynard. I tried the knob, but the door was locked. I glanced at Henry. "I hope we're not seeing a pattern here."
"Do you want me to kick it down, or do you want to?"
I studied the scaly and cupped surface of the interior door, which had spent at least a winter in the high plains exterior. "I think if we breathe on it, it'll collapse." Testing the theory, I grasped the knob and pressed. The door popped open, taking a little of the jam with it. We shrugged at each other. The television was a tiny 13-inch sitting on a beanbag chair, and clothes were scattered across the dirty yellow linoleum-tiled floor and exploded from a large backpack that rested on a built-in bunk. Unlike Tuyen's room, it didn't look like anybody had been killed here, anybody besides Mr. Clean. The bear walked past me, watched Suzanne Rico anchor the news out of Channel 13 in Casper, and then clicked off the TV. There was an open paperback lying on the bed, along with what looked like an old horsehide motorcycle jacket and a number of empty Budweiser bottles, and a full ashtray with a few joints mixed in with the butts. There was another collection of bottles beside the only chair. Henry crossed back and flipped over the book.
"Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance."
"Appropriate." He showed me the cover as proof and then gestured toward the bottles by the chair.
"It would appear that Philip has been entertaining."
I kneeled down and looked at the empties, plucked a pen from my shirt pocket, and tipped one over enough to lift it by the neck. Something rattled at the base, and I saw it was the cap, which had been bent in half. I set the bottle back down and looked up at the Cheyenne Nation. "I guess I'll go check with the owner." Gladys Dietz had rented her swank chicken shed to Philip Maynard for the lofty sum of $100 a month, including utilities. But she was beginning to have second thoughts. I was having second thoughts as she smoked a cigarette with the oxygen tube attached just under her nose, expecting any moment to be blown off the porch. "The TV is going all the time, and that damn motorcycle makes such a racket." She leaned on her walker one-handed and held the screen door back with the other. I knew Gladys. She and her husband had owned a commercial fishing lake that my father and I had frequented, and she had gladly told anybody then that she was intent on dying soon. I had passed more than a half century and was the chief law enforcer in the land, but she still addressed me as if I were 8. I held my hat in my hands. "Mrs. Dietz, your shirt needs ironing, Walter." I self-consciously smoothed the pockets of my uniform and desperately tried to remember her husband's name. "Yes, ma'am. How's George?"
"Dead."
"That's what you got for asking about old people." "I'm sorry to hear that." She shrugged her silver head and studied my unpolished boots.
"I'm not. He was getting pretty cranky toward the end."
I decided to try to keep on track. "Mrs. Dietz, have you seen Philip Maynard today?"
She glanced toward the shack where Henry was standing by the gate.
"What's that Indian doing out near my chicken shed?"
"He's with me."
She looked up through lenses as thick as the windshield on my truck.
"I heard your wife died?"
"Yes, ma'am, a number of years back."
"Was she cranky?"
"No, ma'am." She nodded her head.
"They get like that, you know."
"Yes, ma'am, so they tell me. Now, about Philip Maynard."
"Is he in trouble?"
"We just need to talk to him. Have you seen him?"
She continued watching Henry.
"I usually don't rent to those motorcycle types."
I sighed and hung my hat on the grip of my sidearm and held the screen door for her.
"It's pretty important."
"What is?"
"Philip Maynard."
"What about him?"
I took that extra second that usually keeps me from strangling my constituency, always important in an election year.
"Have you seen him today?"
"No."
I glanced back at Henry.
"Well, his motorcycle isn't here."
"He keeps it in the barn."
I turned and looked at her. "I beg your pardon?"
"That fancy new one that he doesn't want to get rained on."
She glanced past me and at the cloudless sky, the smoldering cigarette still frighteningly close to the oxygen nozzle under her nose.
"Not that it's ever going to do that again."
She watched us as we turned the corner and walked past a corral toward the Dietz barn with a Dutch-style hip roof. "She thinks you're going to steal her chickens."
"There are no chickens."
"See?" It was a standard structure with a roof supported by a number of big, rough-cut 8x8s, which had been sided with raw lumber that had long faded to gray. There was a metal handle with a wooden latch on the door, which I pulled, and we stepped back as the big door swung toward us. Up in the loft, there was a flutter of barn swallows, sounding like angels' wings might. The Harley sat parked on its side stand, swathed with the same cover that I had seen at the bar. Henry lifted the vinyl shroud and whistled.
"What?"
"FLHRS Road King custom job." I vaguely remembered Henry having a bike, but he had rarely ridden it. "What's that mean?"
"Expensive. Close to 20,000.
I thought about the chicken shed.
"Well, he hasn't been spending his money on lodging."
I reached down and felt the chrome-bedecked engine, only vaguely warm. "Then he hasn't ridden it lately." I took a step into the barn proper and let my eyes adjust to the gloom. There was a smell, one that I knew. I unsnapped the safety strap on my .45, pulled the Colt from my holster, and glanced back over my shoulder at Henry. The main breezeway of the barn was empty except for the motorcycle. But there were two other passageways through the stock stalls. I motioned for the bear to head right, and I would take the left. The stalls hadn't been used for their initial purpose for quite some time, but had instead been filled with used lumber, broken equipment, and aged firewood. I worked my way through the four of them and met Henry at the far end of the center breezeway. "Well, he's not hiding in the corn crib." There was more fluttering, and I noticed the scar tissue under Henry's chin as he studied the rafters.
"No, not in the corn crib."
He turned in a circle until he was facing back toward the opening where we'd come in.
"But it appears he has received a suspended sentence."
I turned and followed his eyes up to the rafters where, from a stout length of hemp rope, hung the dangling body of Philip Maynard. How long? T.J. Sherwin was on another call in Otto, so we had Bill McDermott, who was the medical examiner from Billings, Montana. I hadn't seen him since he and Lana Baroja had gone to Guernica together, but it was good to have him back.
Hard to say with the heat, but with rigor and approximate temperature, I'd say it was possibly early this morning, or maybe very late last night.
Suicide?
I hate to guess, but if I was a betting man...
He looked at Maynard's body. The pressure from the base of Philip's neck and from the area where the tongue attaches had forced his lower jaw open, and his tongue stuck out from between his teeth like the parody of a naughty child.
There is some additional contusion alongside the trapezoidal muscle, but that could easily be explained by the force of the drop.
I looked back up at the roof beams, which were at least 18 feet high.
He did a number, didn't he? It takes surprisingly little. You don't even have to be suspended.
What would you suspect?
Bill looked like a choir boy, which belied his occupation. He peered up and calculated. From the loft, I'd say about 6.5 feet.
He pulled back the body bag to reveal a V-shaped abrasion and furrow at the back of Philip Maynard's neck, which had been caused by the rope that had slipped up past the thyroid cartilage.
Incomplete circle where the rope pulled away from the subject.
He looked at the dead man some more.
He didn't change his mind after the fact.
Why?
No fingernail marks at the neck. I've even seen cases where the fingers are trapped under the rope, but this guy dropped the exact distance which resulted in a fractured neck, and we'll probably find the break between the third and fourth, or fourth and fifth cervical vertebrae.
Bill looked up at me.
Was he a bad guy?
I took a breath and felt the closeness of the barn. The light glowing through the spaces between the slats made stripes as if it were shining through bars. I looked at Philip Maynard's sightless eyes, and at the spot where a blood vessel, clouding and unbalancing the pupil, which was ragged at the edge, unlike you'd expect. I'm not sure yet. Saigon, Vietnam, 1968. I watched all the people who crammed into the few tiny blocks around Tudo Street, and thought about all the bars we'd already checked, including the flower brothel, roses, the assorted steam baths, massage parlors, boom-boom rooms, and an honest-to-God Dairy Queen. Even this early in the morning, the street was in full swing, and I suspected it stayed that way for the full 24 hours of the day. It was leaning toward early morning, and I took a deep breath and felt like I was leaking time. Mendoza laughed.
Oh, come on, now, it's not that bad.
Baranski had pulled the jeep half onto the sidewalk, but no one had seemed to notice, not even the two Arvin QCs that we'd almost run over. With their oversized white helmet liners, the Vietnamese military policemen looked like those bobble-headed sports dolls. One of them tried to beg a cigarette from Mendoza, who shook his head and replied, "Toi kong hut tuok lo." Baranski, however, sat on the hood of the jeep and handed the two mice cigarettes, lighting one for himself and then theirs. He paused for a moment and gestured.
Quel son vos nom?
The two introduced themselves as Bui Tin and Van Bo. Baranski pointed at me.
Je suis venu avec quelqu'un d'important. Il s'appelle Sammy Davis Jr.
The two QCs looked up, so I smiled and raised a fist. Black power. Baranski continued.
Il vous passe un bon moment. Tu vois ce que je veux dire?
Bui Tin gestured toward the bustling street.
Choisissez une des portes.
Baranski nodded his head and gestured helplessly with both hands.
Oui, mais il aime les cowboys. Et il voudrait quelque chose qui fasse un peu western.
Tin, who seemed to be in charge, pointed to a side street.
Il y a un club qui s'appelle Western Town. Un peu plus bas, sur ce trottoir.
As we walked past them, Van Bo grasped my hand and shook it.
Je suis tellement heureux de vous rencontrer, Monsieur Davis. J'ai tous vos disques.
I followed after Baranski and Mendoza and nodded, completing the conversation with 2 of the 12 French words I knew. Merci beaucoup. I caught up with them as they turned the corner.
What did he say?
Baranski stopped and looked across the street to where a neon cowgirl's leg kicked up and down in a more than provocative manner and gestured to a hand-painted sign that read, Western Town.
He said he's got all your albums.
Static. There are no records with the Chicago Police Department other than the ones from the reports we've already received.
No next of kin?
Static. There was a mother in Evanston, but that number's been disconnected. I sighed and stared at the mic in my hand. All right, pending any further information from the great state of Illinois,
We'll file Philip Maynard with the boys up in Billings. Anybody comes looking for him, and we'll defer to that other great state.
Static. And what are we?
I keyed the mic. Somewhere between. What's the word on Tran Van Toyen?
Static. He lost a lot of blood, but it looks like he'll make it. Isaac Bloomfield says it's a pretty good blunt trauma from a not-so-blunt instrument.
Meaning?
Static. He said something like an angle iron.
Or a motorcycle part?
Static. Possibly, but why didn't he kill Tian?
Remorse.
Static. That would explain both crimes, wouldn't it?
Roger that. I started to hang up the mic.
Static. Walt?
I keyed it again. Yep.
Static. Anything you'd like me to tell Katie?
Where are they?
Static. They were talking about coming down there.
Tell them not to. I'll be in Durant soon. I need to talk to Tuyen, but I have to make another stop before I head back.
Static. Roger that. Hey, you didn't sing.
I watched Philip Maynard's body being loaded into a step van. I guess my heart isn't in it. Bill came over and joined us as I backed out of the open door of the unit, propped my forearms on the top of the window, and looked at Henry, who had just rolled up the sleeves of his faded blue chambray shirt. He still looked cool and crisp, even in the heat.
Is this what they call an open-and-shut case?
I nudged my hat back and rested my chin on my forearms. I didn't look cool, didn't feel it either.
As far as Philip is concerned, it is.
I stared at the shiny glare of chromed reflection in the Harley's air cleaner, wondering where somebody like Maynard would get the money for a $20,000 motorcycle, and then voiced my real concern.
I'm wondering why he would want to kill Hoti Paquette, let alone Tuyen.
Henry wrapped his arms over his chest, and I watched the muscles bunch under the dark skin, reminding me of the coiled rattler in the ghost town.
Perhaps she came back into the bar and things got a little rough.
There are the charges from Chicago, but I'm just not sure. I stopped suddenly and thought of the woman on the fax.
Damn.
I leaned back in the vehicle and keyed the mic. Ruby, you there?
Static. You ready with your reprise? Find the name of the woman who had the restraining order on Maynard and see if you can get me a phone number.
Static. Roger that. I straightened back up, and the Cheyenne Nation was beside the door, along with McDermott.
What charges?
There was a domestic disturbance and assault charge, and a restraining order concerning a woman in Chicago, Carol Griffith, I think her name was. McDermott looked between the two of us. So this Maynard fellow had a record?
Yeah, but something about all of this doesn't seem right.
And I'd like to talk to somebody who actually knew him before I tag him posthumously with murder in the first and attempted homicide.
Static. Walt?
I'm here.
Static. It's a work number.
I copied it down.
Tattoo you.
Thanks.
I tossed the mic back on the seat as the bear reached down and pulled out his cell phone from a nifty little leather holster at his belt.
So do you want to make a phone call?
I nodded.
Yep, then we'll go get to Yen's Land Rover. I figure he'll appreciate us picking up his stuff and bringing his car to him.
Henry smiled.
That, and it will give you another chance to look over his room and the vehicle?
There's that.
He nodded.
I'll drive the Land Rover.
We parked by the veterinarian's office, and Henry dialed the number and handed me the phone. Miss Griffith answered on the second ring. She sounded personable and precise. I told her why I was calling, and she became less personable but still precise.
He beat up my car.
The reception, even in this key part of Powder Junction, was spotty at best.
He what? He beat up my charger with a baseball bat, but he paid to have it fixed the next day.
There was a pause. I had learned from years of experience to never interrupt the flow.
I'm sorry to hear he's dead. Was it that piece of shit motorcycle?
The new one?
New hell, he could hardly keep that ancient piece of crap running.
We're not really sure. I decided to keep the details to myself. Miss Griffith, would you say Mr. Maynard was given to acts of physical violence as a matter of course?
No, not really.
I thought about it. But you say he beat up your car? I listened to the silence on the line.
Well, that was kind of my fault.
In what way?
I beat up his motorcycle first.
It was quiet on the line again, and I listened to, or imagined, the thousands of relays, switches, and electric impulses within the cellular system.
He wasn't particularly devoted to our relationship. He had this thing for Asian girls.
It was only a block and a half from anywhere to anywhere in Powder Junction, so rather than suffer the tin can of a Suburban, we parked at the office and walked to the hole-in-the-wall motel.
So she said he had this constant stream of Asian women he brought in from Canada?
Suspicious, considering the circumstances.
Yes.
We walked past Ethan and Devon, the two young boys who had identified Tuyen's Land Rover. They were dressed in another set of automotive T-shirts. I waved, and they waved back.
And what about Virgil White Buffalo? With the most recent developments, you cannot still be seriously considering him as a suspect.
I took a deep breath and felt the hot afternoon air burnish my lungs. I don't know what I'm going to do about Virgil. Henry stepped in front of me.
Let him go.
I pulled up and stared at the dirt street. I can't do that, and you know it. His eyes stayed steady on me.
Why not?
He's a potential witness to a homicide, and I don't think he can be released on his own recognizance. I took another breath, but still found it hard to look at him. Henry, he fought two highway patrolmen and two deputies to a standstill,
trying to stay out of jail for a crime he didn't commit.
I sighed. Look, we can't be sure he has spent enough time behind bars for one life. I finally looked at him because I was getting a little angry. If he is a potential danger to himself or anyone else, he becomes my responsibility. He shifted his eyes, and they shone like shards of obsidian.
And where does that responsibility end?
It doesn't. We stood there, the echo of my voice coming back at us from the empty street, louder than I'd intended. It doesn't ever end. Ever. I spoke softly now. As long as he's in my county, he's my responsibility, and that puts me in line with a lot of other people who might consider leaving a 7-foot sociopath in a culvert under the highway a serious dereliction of duty.
So, you are going to keep him incarcerated for the common good?
Until I can find somewhere for him to go, yes. I started to walk around him and then stopped. Henry, I can't let him continue to live under the highway. It's not humane.
Neither is keeping him caged like an animal.
I took another breath, this one even hotter than the ones before, and held it for a moment. I am aware of that. I continued on a few steps before turning and looking back at him.
What?
He stood there for a moment and studied me.
I know you.
And what's that supposed to mean? He didn't move.
What?
I know that the real reason you are holding Virgil is in an attempt to fix his life, and that is beyond your abilities. You look at him and see experiences and directions similar to yours, but badly taken.
He walked toward me.
You cannot correct the path he has chosen. It is his path. The only thing you can do